Welcome to The Great Security Debate. This show has experts taking sides to help broaden understanding of a topic. Therefore, it's safe to say that the views expressed are not necessarily those of the people we work with or for. Heck, they may not even represent our own views as we take a position for the sake of the debate. Our website is greatsecuritydebate.net, and you can contact us via email at feedback@greatsecuritydebate.net or on Twitter at securitydebate. Now, let's join the debate already in progress.
Cyber insurance is going to play heavily into this, not only because most of us, as part of our insurance policy, have third-party risk.
Mm-hmm.
So I do think this plays together. And I think it's a conversation. I just did a podcast, or I guess it was more of an interview with somebody else, and was talking about that it goes back to the efficiencies we gain by integrating everything, but the additional risk we now incur because everything's connected, right?
Yeah.
And I think this is also, buzzword du jour, this is one of the problems we have with AI as well, not on the connectivity piece, but on the reliance piece, right? That as we start using automation and other techniques.
Yes, it becomes very sticky.
To do from a manual perspective to get rid of that, we forget about how to do the manual aspects. So when we need to go back to them, we haven't done this. Who knows?
That's actually, when you tie all those pieces together, even more interesting, because again, taking CDK and the idea of dealerships having to go back to pen and paper, right? In your business continuity plan, did you have a provision that said, yes, when this happens, go to closet A, pull out the 5,000 pens, distribute.
Right.
Go to closet B, pull out the 5,000 notebooks with invoicing and distribute, right? Like,
well, it's like, no, it's like the old workplace recovery plans that we've sort of gotten away from now that everything's virtual and everyone can work from everywhere. So we don't think through the logistics of you know, exactly what it takes at any given moment to do anything.
100%. Well, and how many of those plans have actually been tested? I know I've sat in manufacturing tabletops where when you start to bring in operational people, that they'll swear up and down, you know, as you're going through the timeline, all right, we're down for 2 hours. All right, we're still good. We can ship, we can do all this. All right, we're down for 10 hours. And they'll, oh no, we're still good. We have manual processes. Do you really, are they really sustainable for that long? Right.
And can you really withhold yourself at hour eight, Mr. Business Owner, or line of business owner, P&L holder? Why isn't this back up? I know I said it was 10, but I lied.
Yeah. And I feel like
manufacturing is in that unique position where when you're pulling in the operation side, maybe they can, but they're continue to produce parts, but at some point there, it's all the other systems internally, right, that are a pull versus push methodology in your supply chain of how you're communicating, right? Going back to kind of the theme, right? Now, how are you communicating to your suppliers? Like, let's say if this went on for 2 days, you have sub-suppliers as well that are bringing in parts. How are you communicating to them what you've used and what you haven't used if you can't put that information into a system? And how do you ensure that every single one of your sub-suppliers, if you have 400, 500, 1,000 sub-suppliers, because it's not just one assembly line, it's multiple different assembly lines with multiple variations.
Well, 100%. There's three lenses, right? You have pre-production, production, and post-production, right? Pre-production and being able to understand where your raw inventory incoming is so that you can produce the parts, most of it being just in time. All right, so maybe as we're sitting in that center lens, that operations stay up and you're able to run the machinery. But at some point, as we start looking, creating additional bottlenecks, right, that on the post-production, if your ERP is critical to connecting to your freight companies and getting that inventory off the floor so you can get it out to the OE, and that starts backing up, there's incremental issues along the line. Pun intended, along the line.
Boy, you'd never know that Eric wasn't in automotive anymore.
I know, I'm sitting back like, hey, are you making an automotive reference or just a manufacturing reference in general? Feel free to tag it. if you would like. Yeah, but then taking that back to insurance conversation, right? Because manufacturing's had some of those things put in place to protect themselves when catastrophe hits, right? So like, if you're supplying to an OE using automotive as the example, a Ford, GM, et cetera, anything that brings you down, right? Like a tool breaks, you had, you know, this little incident, somebody doesn't show up for work, you're on the hook to your customer to get that production done. But then you get into the idea of when we have some of those massive storms that come through. Let's talk hurricanes. Let's talk tornadoes, et cetera. That's where the force majeure comes in, right? Like, this was unintended. It impacted a large area, more than just one supplier. It wasn't just supplier A over here. It was all the suppliers within this region got affected, the logistics, the shipping, energy, right, being down. And that's typically where inside your insurance policy, you have coverage there as well. Now moving over into the cyber side.
Possibly have coverage.
Possibly well, have
coverage. On the cyber side.
So on the cyber side, though, you know, moving over to that side of it, like this isn't a hurricane. This isn't a tornado. It feels like it when it happens, right? The two biggest providers of this software to the automotive retail market, Reynolds and Reynolds, CDK. So one of them gets hit, they go down. It's kind of like a hurricane. It's like it took out this whole swath, right? Like you said, Eric, within policy, depending on how your policy is written, you have some third-party risk inside there, right? So maybe you're covered. But now you're the insurance companies. And just like ransomware, you know, 3-4 years ago was picking up, 5 years ago was picking up more and more steam. And they're like, we need to start making sure people have, you know, these five things put in place. Now we need to make sure they're doing those five things. And now we're actually saying that you have to have EDR, you have to do a pen test once a year. We're saying you got to do some bit of vulnerability scanning or risk management at least twice a year, right? Like putting these things in there. That was because they were paying out so much money. When you see things like CDK, this is now two in a row that have impacted from a third-party standpoint, and it hits 15,000 dealerships overnight, not just one. If you're the insurance company and you're looking at all your policies and you're like, oh, this is a massive impact, because it literally is, that's like the manufacturing line of the retail auto market just went down. Like,
yeah.
Right. But so interestingly, just this week, there was a an article in the Wall Street Journal. The insurers are actually now, despite that desire for standardization or for consistency, the government now is looking at what standardizing cyber policies would look like. And the insurers are going, oh, not so fast. We don't want you prescribing this, because otherwise we would end up reducing more. They would, this is on the other side, this is the carve outs, the other thing. So there, it's a two edges. There's two edges to this sword, one on standard inputs, but also on standard outputs. But the insurers want it to be very, you know, very standard coming in, but no, we want to be able to make the calls on what we cover. I think that this is going to end up being a, you know, quite a battle as they, is there become a minimum base coverage? If you look at automotive insurance in the U.S., you know, state by state, different levels of coverage, different levels of liability, but all guided by some pretty hefty rules within that state. Some more draconian, some more insurer friendly, some more consumer friendly. I guess, where do we think we're going to end up with that on the coverage side? Because all the protections in the world don't mean anything if you don't have adequate coverage, if it doesn't actually cover you when the thing happens.
Well, and this is my biggest scare, or actually, you know, as I look at it, first and foremost, the federal government has to do something, right? I think that's where it needs to come from. And I think we already have the wireframe for the framework, right? Let's go back to Sarbanes-Oxley. That prior to that, you had a bunch of financial issues with Enron and some others, government stepped in and actually think they did a good job on that one that said, we're not going to be prescriptive, but what we are going to ask you to do is you have to build controls within these categories. And then we are going to have the audit firms measure you to make sure you're actually adhering to the controls that you put in place, right? My biggest issue though, is I think as I look at the insurance companies, we continue in our space to gravitate towards prescriptive controls. Mm-hmm. And that would be the equivalent of Sarbanes-Oxley saying you have to run Oracle or you have to run SAP and coming in and actually dictating how things are done. No.
But I still don't doubt that that's exactly what the insurance companies would like to get to. Run this with this configuration and therefore we could be comfortable.
But that's not what I'm seeing though. When I see an insurance firm come in and have a recommended set of technology providers, that tells me we are actually veering off and going to the prescriptive, right? And that worries me that if we are all, the expectation is now that the cost of business is having a cyber insurance policy, mm-hmm. right? I don't think we're at a point where it's going to be acceptable anymore that you go, well, I'm just going to self-insure for this. That there is an expectation from customers and others that you have those insurance policies in place, right? And if insurance policies then are going to start to dictate the technologies that we have to put in while fully agreeing that the intent might be that we're creating better security, but what you actually create is you're pushing only certain technologies that no longer are selling based on innovation and what they're doing for curbing risk. It's purely because they are now in bed with insurance companies. And I think long-term, if we look at that, that stifles innovation, right? That if I'm being told by my insurance provider, here's the list that you're allowed to choose from. I'm sorry, Mr. Sharp, you might have the best idea on the block. This is a new way to look at security, but you're not on my list. So there's nothing.
Medical formularies.
And I worry about this. Now, the one thing I will give to insurance that as we start to look at the actuarials and stuff that we have now, is getting better and predicting controls within certain categories on their ability to impact downstream risk. But I still feel like we have to recognize it's always going to be a lagging indicator. Mm-hmm. And there's some room to grow. There's other opportunities to look at this through other lenses.
So Eric, I was recently at a CXO Forum event and up on the panel. And actually, I think you were on the panel. Are you changing your tune slightly on insurance and how insurance is going to drive the future of cyber risk and inherently get the world better?
What might I have said? No, so I'm going to say it depends, right? So I'm going to
that'll be a dollar, please.
So the point that I was trying to make is that the problem we have within the industry is we have not standardized our language, right? If we look at finance and accounting, we have GAAP. We have other things that define what these terms mean. EBITDA is EBITDA. Free cash flow is free cash flow, right? As we use some of these metrics. Now, as you get into public reporting, then you start to get into those nuances. It's adjusted EBITDA. Okay, what does that actually mean? It means we know you're messing with your numbers to make it look better, right? But I think we're missing that on the security side. I think insurance can help us build that lexicon, that vernacular, to start to get us singing from the same hymnal, if you will. But I don't think they are going to be the ones. I don't think they're in the right position to be the dictator of that on a go-forward basis because it's a conflict of interest for them. But if we can start to get to the point that, you know, between the three of us, if we were to define risk to our organization, what does maturity mean? These are all very subjective terms, depending on the framework, depending on what you're talking about, that we're talking from three very different angles. And I think we can start to bring that together to homogenize the language set so that when we speak about risk in different areas, it means the same across different companies.
But when I make my definition and you make your definition, neither one of us will want to accept the others because I'm special snowflake. And this is a big problem. I mean, this is a big issue with everything. Yes, it's going to come back to security questionnaires. why can't you use standard instruments? Well, because you would they don't properly, fully, comprehensively describe my organization.
Right.
And those kind of things where we're killing ourselves. But I think we're going to run into that same problem here where insurer A and insurer B and insurer C will think about things differently. And that commoditization of the insurance provider actually removes the competitiveness in that space, which is one of the reasons I think they're going to push back and fight and not get to single instruments, not get to single methodologies, because in their mind, it's what differentiates them rather sure. than, and that is a competitive differentiator. I do this, I score like this. I've got a little bit easier, a little bit more risk tolerance in these spaces. And therefore these types of companies will be drawn toward this insurance provider versus others.
Sure. I mean, this is where I come back. And I was actually having a conversation recently with somebody in legal, made the comment that there's a lot of security that's more of an art than a science, that it is, yeah. it's highly nuanced. And that is one of the risks that we run. That if we try to become too standardized, that we take that out of the equation and make every program very, very predictable. And it allows us, or it takes away the ability to get into some creative compensating controls that in many cases, from my view, are actually better than the original control that was being asked for from some of these frameworks that frankly, I'm still not a big fan of a lot of the frameworks. They take too long to update. They're completely outdated.
In the chat, a little roll call on the Supreme Court's decision on the Chevron ruling, which we'll see if this has an impact within cybersecurity, because essentially what they were rolling back, or what the Chevron decision meant or could help protect, was the idea that from a indifferent standpoint, so like, let's see if I can get this right when I read this. So if Chevron's overruled, now the court is abandoning a 40-year precedent that basically held that the courts may no longer defer to federal agencies' reasonable interpretations of ambiguous legislation, mm-hmm. right? And I think in the security space, that's where, so Eric, we were talking about insurance help leading the way, and then kind of moving that towards government helping leading the way. But now with those federal agencies, there is a lot of ambiguity on what our requirements, whether it's CISA, whether it's Homeland, et cetera, who's ever overseeing cybersecurity rules, bylaws, legislation, et cetera.
Right.
This is interesting because now it plays out like when you go back towards, not Stuxnet. What was the one that impacted all the shipping and so forth and took down Mondelez? What's that?
WannaCry,
right? And that ended up becoming basically like a force majeure. It was like, you know, Mondelez was claiming, well, this was, you know, fallout from an act of war, right?
Right. Yeah, but you can't go in depending on a force majeure claim. And because force majeure is one of those things that is very, I mean, it's got a long history of attempts to, you know, you claim it and attempts to say, no, it wasn't. And I think this, by default, the current posture is that more of these things are being classified other ways, like in the carve-outs, the acts of war, nation state, etc., that fall away from modern coverage. I think going in with the hope or expectation that force majeure will be your cover, I think that is just asking for trouble in the long run.
Who's to say that a good portion of ransomware right now isn't, look, hear me out here. When you're in war and you're walking down the street with your submachine gun, right, headed to battle, and it's like, oh, let's break into this convenience store and steal some chips. Right on. Let's go on in. You go on in, right? And you can shoot your gun in any direction you want, scare the people out, you steal some chips, right?
Just to clarify, this is a hypothetical, right?
Where is this going?
Hypothetical, right? But those same people in today's war, though, are sitting online, right? Why did you see ransomware dip? Because people got enlisted. Now the country that's at war, Russia with Ukraine, telling those same people that are enlisted, I get it that you need to make some money. Okay, go rob a few convenience stores while you're doing your job, right? And it, that's not to say that the spike in ransomware is slightly caused by the people that are enlisted being like, hey, Mother Russia, man, I got to make some money. Like, I ain't making any money. I need to go back to my ways, right? And it's like, feel free. Feel free to pop a few stores while you're going down the street. Because that's essentially, like, yes, today's war is being fought online, right? Using cyber in, as well as missiles, et cetera. But back then, that's what soldiers were doing when they would walk through cities and loot and take what they want. They want to be able to go back and get their loot. So, Dan, who's not to say that, you know, 50% of everything that's happening right now is technically an act of war because the people doing it are the same soldiers that are enlisted right now. I mean, I'm just putting it out there. There's so much ambiguity.
There is. And yeah, this is the interesting thing. And I know we've talked about it on one of our podcasts. That's it. Is interesting. Like if you start to look at physical war versus cyber war, right? So pick on CDK. If another country came in and occupied their buildings, there is an immediate physical force that comes to bear to help them out of that situation. Ah, but now it's online. That's your fault. That's your fault. You didn't do it. You allowed them in. It doesn't add up to me. Now, part of it is that this is in the grand scheme of things, right? If you look at the percentage of time where wars were fought physically versus digitally, we're still in our infancy. And I'm sure some of that plays into it in trying to figure this out. Because frankly, and well, I'll add to it that I think there's a certain level of healthy fear in government intervention and stepping in and what it would cause for escalation.
Mm-hmm.
We've all read the stories of being on what we've heard about. If you go back to Russia being in a dam in upstate New York, and luckily it was under maintenance, so they weren't unable to open it. We know about it, water treatment plants in Florida, right? That as we start looking at some of this infrastructure, I think there's a fear of, well, if we step in and they go nuclear, what happens, right?
Let's go back to a little bit on the insurance side. All right. So I was reading an interesting book called The End of the World is Just the Beginning. Okay. And it sounds a lot scarier than it really is. But what's unique about it is looking at demographics, population densities as countries have grown, right? How wars attributed to additional globalization, urbanization, et cetera. And then after World War II, the Woods Treaty, which basically allowed or allied in the U.S. walked out of every country that technically for the first time in history the winner was occupying, gave those countries back or at least left, but with the Woods Treaty said we're going to protect the shipping lanes. An interesting thing happened when Reagan was in office and one of these ships was attacked. All right, people don't think of piracy today, although piracy has been huge, especially online piracy, which has caused the cost of certain goods to go up. When this ship was attacked, imagine your shoes, right? Which the $80 pair of shoes, the cost of your insurance for that shoe today is 10 cents. The cost of shipping and fuel and logistics is less than a penny, right? That's very low, right? But when that attack occurred, the cost of shoes was going to skyrocket because insurance was going to go way up. So now every ship that traveled through the Suez Canal got an American flag shoved on the back of it. Why? Because with the Woods Treaty, anyone that shot a bullet at that then was able to be attacked by said Navy because there was American flag on it. So regardless of what countries really thought of America, right, they're still getting their $80 shoe because they were able to plop a flag on the back of it and the U.S. Navy was protecting it. We don't have a Woods Treaty in cyber to protect the shipping lanes across the world, et cetera. And the interesting thing there is the reason to do that was everyone panicked that the insurance for shipping was going to go so high that it was going to make the cost of goods unsustainable to keep that globalization current going, right? And why do ships, why is the cost of fuel less than a penny on every one of those shoes? Because you don't have to worry about piracy, so the ship can go 10 knots. It's just putzing through, right? If the ship had to go 35 knots, the fuel consumption would cause the cost of fuel to be 4x. The internet's a beautiful thing, but I'm telling you, the cost of insurance on a baby is going, which means the cost of goods is going up.
Yeah, I mean, it really, it's a really good point. And of course, nobody wants price rises. Yes, we've got other inflationary, impacts. I do renewals on things, and I say, you got to keep it to 3%. And anything around that, take this out into the physical world, the world we all live in. You go to restaurants, and you go to a restaurant, and every restaurant owner seems hesitant to raise the actual price of the food, of the items in there, even though those costs, including insurance costs, are going higher. But then it comes in the form of bizarre surcharges that remove transparency from the total cost. So, in your example, do we then see shoes that are $80 plus a $5.50 insurance security fee plus a $1.50, fast gas through the Suez fee plus the, whereas, so now you do 80, but you really don't walk out for a hunt until 180. I'm spending time in Europe again recently. You remember what it's like. You remember how nice it is that the price you see on the sticker is the amount of money you have to have in your hand to hand over. And that's, then you walk out of the store with your, with your shoes. No additional taxes, no hidden fees, no other things.
But if you look at it, so I was just looking it up. I was wondering, like, what's the average age in Congress right now? What do you think it is?
I'd go 74.
Ooh. 64.
Okay. What'd you say, Brian?
64.
All right. Well, you guys are a bit high. So 57.9.
Oh, that's way younger than I would have expected. Way younger.
But still, if you put that in the context, as we think about not going all the way back to ARPANET, which I think was created in 69, roughly mm-hmm. that era. But yeah. If you look at the modern era of when the internet really kind of boomed, what are we talking? Mid-90s. Right?
Yeah, early 90s. Yeah, 92, 93, 94, 95. Yeah, for regular consumers, mid 90s.
So if you look at the comparison for understanding of a way of doing things for a long time, using Brian, your example of transporting things over water, that is age old, right? That goes way back. So the people that have come up understand the protection, the need for those type of goods and what's going on. We're still talking about something that is, in the test of time, relatively new, and even newer comparatively to the people that are making those decisions. And I think there's still a vast lack of understanding on what is truly going on in our world and how complex it really is.
Agree, but disagree just slightly. Only because if you do the math, mid-90s, 57, age. So the midnight. So I am not all that far from that age. I was the first to come into, when I went to university, that was when we were starting the earliest pieces of the internet. I'd argue that people in the 5 to 10 year older than me range also experienced that in its prime. I think the far end, the octogenarian and septuagenarian end of our legislature doesn't get it. But at that 57, if that truly is the median, I think that's giving too easy of a pass.
I don't know, though, because the internet at that point is not the internet we have today. The complexity, it was pure connectivity, right? What are we talking about? You could
connect. Was genuine.
You could connect to AOL, ICQ. You had kind of this handful of services that everybody was consolidated on, and not near the complexity of the modular economic society that we have today of all of these companies being interrelated and how it works. So I'm not there. I think there's still a gap in totally understanding. So thinking about it, kind of going back to what you brought up, Brian, and the Chevron. And it becomes interesting because as I look at CISA as being an agency, I feel like that is one that isn't given the power that it actually needs to create interpretation on what needs to be done. And I would say what CIS has been doing under, who is it, Jen?
Easterly.
Yeah, has been phenomenal, right? We've talked about the SSO tax and all of that that they're starting to take on, but I still don't think they have any teeth as an agency to opine and curb legislation. And that's got to start to change. They're not near as powerful as an EPA or some of the others that we know.
Does the Chevron Act then take some of that away from the agencies, right? Where it's, well, we're going to defer to the agency because they wrote this. You tell us, is there ambiguity? No, here's what it is, right? Even though, yeah, there's some ambiguity. Jen going around, and I'm careful what I say here because I'm a big fan of Jen Easterly, right? And I like the persona that she brings into that office and the type of personality she brings as well, right? You look at a leader versus a boss. So instead of her pointing a finger, she's always reaching a hand out, right? A boss points a finger, leader puts his hand out and says, come with me. But when you put that out and you have these guys sign on the dotted line to say, hey, you know, when it comes to writing software and code, we are going to adhere and be better. And we're going to adhere to what you proposed in front of us. And we're not going to have the CIO or the CISO sign it. We're going to have the CEO sign it. That's great. But it feels to me a little more like, hey, we'll get all these guys to sign it. And then when one of them has a massive hiccup, right, now we can pull them in and be like, hey, remember when you signed this, right? You said you were going to do better. You did, right? It's like Microsoft one day saying, we are about to take security so serious, you have no idea. And then the next day it's, oh crap, we rolled out a new AI that plugs everything in. We apologize that we didn't take it serious, but that group wasn't talking to the group that was taking it serious.
Yeah. It was already in the pipeline before we signed, I swear.
Is that right? Is that like handing the police officer a baton where his only stop, or I'll say stop again, right?
Yeah. I think there's a big piece to that, or seeing as a technical advisor rather than an enforcement role. Yeah, was it NCIS, the television show, where they have the technical they have the technical team, but they really just are there to tell you things, and then they may or may the actual characters may or may not decide to follow it. I think that's often the way I see how those organizations are seen and felt throughout our government. I think other countries have some very effective relationships with their and not the countries we worry are the ones attacking us. I think some of the certs, some of the national certs that exist have really, really strong relationships.
But I'll go back to, I'm going to blame some of that on us. And this is something I believe I said on that same panel, Brian, right? That
when you say on us, on me, you, Dan, and it.
Just the three of us.
Okay.
As technologists, right? So holistically looking across the technology field, and more specifically pointing the finger at your traditional security people that are coming up, we still speak a foreign language. That's a problem. As soon as we gravitate back to what's natural and geek speaking, the rest of the world just goes, I don't know.
Isn't that cute?
Yeah. Okay. Just sit down at your Fisher Price table over here. We've got real things to do.
100% right. When I was just out in New York sitting next to a CFO, and when I was up on stage talking, I literally took a line from the CXO Forum event to talk about communication. Right. One of the things that I've heard come out in the last few weeks that fails when something really bad happens is that everyone's gone through a business continuity plan or some type of tabletop, but they really haven't thought through the communication piece of, let's put everybody in a separate room, right, and figure out how we're going to communicate to each other and communicate to this plant over here if we can't use our email, or how do we communicate to the public, right? And the CFO said to me, he goes, yeah, he goes, Brian, don't, like, this is all done. And now I'm sitting next to him. He goes, don't take this the wrong way. He's like, but I think the biggest problem I have with the communication, he goes, and I try to make myself as technically adapt as possible and look things up is the person talking to me can't explain it. And I'll tell them like, okay, talk to me like I'm a 5-year-old. Explain it one more time because I have no clue what you're talking about. Right?
Totally agree. I just went through this again with somebody recently. It was a presentation somebody asked me to take a look at. Not, you know, it was unrelated to mine, my organization or others, but it was a technical, it was a business impacts type thing. We want to do this, we want to do this business case. So, but it completely lacked the so what. So perhaps this is the other phrase other than it depends that I whip out a lot, which is what's so what? What's the business impact to this? Is this going to, what's this going, doing this or not doing this? What's it going to enable, disable, make easier, make more revenue, not make more revenue? Tell me what it is. You can have all the technical in the world and do that. Continue to have the evidence and detail. But at the end, so what? We're going to block 750 million vulnerabilities. So what? And that means we can do this. We put this in. It means we can then, you know, check 4 boxes on our insurance and reduce it by 30%. Those are the kind of things that get you to be able to stay in the room and get you asked questions again.
It's almost like where the 5 whys came from Toyota. Wasn't that where that? Yeah. It's almost like. We need to start thinking about the reverse of that. Right.
Mm-hmm.
We start at the bottom. Why we got to get up to that first. Why? Get to that high level instead of, we know the root cause, we know what's going on technically, but if you don't create that abstraction layer to start speaking in other terms, you're spot on. Nobody else gets it.
Right.
Yeah. I never thought of it that way. Instead of doing the 5 why to get to the root cause, let's do the 5 why to get to the, what is the actual impact and is it material? Does anybody really care? Right. Because if businesses and organizations start to push down inside their requirements that, do you have insurance? Like, we want to know that you have insurance. So if something bad happens, it's protecting our bottom line over here. And then that company looks at it and says, okay, here's my cost for insurance. To get the insurance, I got to do these 5 things. To do those 5 things, 3 of them, I got to buy something. Here's my total cost, right? Management. That's what we got to do. And it's like, whoa, now we got to create a new budget. So now the companies and businesses, and I can say from working for a Japanese auto manufacturer, there was a lot of Japanese suppliers that looked at that 3-4 years ago with Toyota and were like, you're telling us we have to do these things. Here's what the cost is going to be. And the OEs, Toyota, Ford, et cetera, were like, we're not telling you have to do this. You should have been doing this because that's how you protect the manufacturing. But again, then they started turning it into compliance. Well, to get this level of compliance, you have to do these controls. For some of those controls, you had to buy things. And then the suppliers took that and said, well, you said we have to be this compliance and it cost us this to do it. So we're going to increase the cost of every part by 2 pennies. Right.
Yeah. Like, but I think
everything was, how can we recover this cost?
But that is part of the total cost of goods sold. And that is one of the things, back to my comment about raising the price on the restaurant, I think at some point you do need to account for this. Otherwise you have a completely false understanding of what it costs to run your product, run your service, run your business. And therefore the incongruity between that and what the market will bear is very much a real thing.
Right. If you're Ford, Toyota, GM, et cetera, and you look at what your budgets have been and how they've increased in security over the last 5-10 years, all you have to simply do with your suppliers is show us what your budget for security has been over the last 10 years, right? It's like, guys, for us to be the OE, we had to do this. We're telling our suppliers they need to do it, but they don't have the budget. If those suppliers had to increase their budget, it is going to have a material impact on their bottom line.
Yeah,
when they're reporting, right? So you also want your supplier to be healthy and not go out of business because they ultimately still need to provide parts. So this goes across the board. This isn't just a manufacturing issue. I mean,
no, not at all. This is purely thinking out loud on this one. It becomes interesting, right? That if you were starting to do financial analysis on a company, that as you're looking at, whether you're looking at free cash flow, whether you're looking at EBITDA, at some point, specifically in manufacturing, something that is capital intensive and you want to see investments, because investments in capital means should tie to future earnings, right? You're not investing in PPE, so your plant, property, and equipment. You aren't going to have what's needed to actually produce a good, thus lowering your valuation down the road, right? And I almost wonder if that's, you need the financial minds to start to change on this, and that cyber becomes part of that equation, right? Now, granted, most of ours have shifted to amortization, but looking at that percentage or increase of spend over time within organizations to protect the revenue stream of an actual organization.
Yeah, I take the Roman Legion, for example. All of those roads that they built that went from Rome into other countries across Europe, et cetera, were built, and at the time it was considered amazing, but all those roads combined don't even equal all the highways within Maine. But what it did was it stretched an army so thin, because as those Roman legions had to patrol those roadways, because those roadways were built to bring grain back and spoils back to Rome, right? Taxes. But those taxes were all to help pay the legions to protect those roadways. The legions today for shipping lanes has the U.S. Navy, you know, for 85, 90% of the world. But when it comes to cyber, and this is going to the global aspect of it, there has to be a way to say, how do we protect those, and I'll use the term shipping lanes, right? But those networks, that communication, that data, right? And right now, most organizations focus on it and it's a single as their network, But if you looked at this holistically, how we need to communicate, right? Why you protect the entire highway? Why you protect the entire ocean, right? It's a global thing. Right. And I think that's kind of where we're at. Now, I don't want to pivot here, but I did think this was funny because you did talk about the debate. And you, the average age of somebody in Congress at 57. I know that the three of us all have children. We also have grandparents. Have you ever thought to yourself, and I'm not poking at my own mom and dad, but in reality, I don't necessarily trust my mom and dad watching the kids for more than a few days because I know they get very tired, right? My mom and dad are actually younger than both presidential candidates that we're debating. I think you should ask yourself, do I trust them to watch my children for more than 24 hours? And if the answer is no.
Well, considering my mom and dad are regular viewers, hi, mom, hi, dad. I will say they are spry and they are act like they're in their 40s. But no, I mean, I think your point's right on, Brian. There's definitely some benchmarking in real life that is hard to notice from those that you don't interact with every day, like presidential candidates, like senatorial and others that are all at arm's length, and you see them on TV or you see the personas that they put out there and you wonder, you lose sight of the fact that there is entire generation, multiple generations at times, between you and the work you're doing that is modern and those that are deciding the fates of it. You know, to take it out of childcare and put it into, you know, into governing, into legislation, into insurance, into other things. I think those are the, there really is a delta in understanding and capability and ability to, you know, ability to want to understand or want to change. The phrase old, you know, can't teach an old dog new tricks is a truism for a reason. It is hard to shift people who have gone through 80 years of their lives in a particular way or seen particular things. I mean, I'm already seeing it myself, you know, the crustiness of my unwillingness to, you know, change, to use, you know, to use certain new things that are coming up, you know, the TikTok. I have no idea what it's like. I've never used it. Those kinds of things. So I guess it's not too far-fetched, but your point is well made.
But in the same sense, in kind of their defense, I think it's harder to start looking at and understanding the where things might be hosted, what things are actually doing. It's way more complex online because the global economy there, it's just in my browser. I'm going to trust it because it came up on Facebook. It came up on all of these things. Like I was having a conversation at one point that somebody that was investing a cryptocurrency on an exchange, And they're like, oh yeah, well, everybody's getting into crypto now, and started to walk through on, hey, do you actually know where that exchange is hosted? No, it was a friend that recommended it to me. Okay, that exchange specifically is out of Belarus. Given the location and propensity, kind of what's going around in that area, probably not the best idea. But I think there's, because it's online, there's this abstraction layer.
Yeah.
Wasn't there before, on being able to understand that, hey, I'm going to do business with Meijer. Well, I know Meijer is a Michigan-based company. There's a certain level of trust because they're locally, right? You don't get that as easily in the online space. But I think there's an increased implicit trust that comes with it for some reason that, well, it's online. It must be true.
I think some of that's even lost in shopping on Amazon, meaning where are things produced? Where are they made, right? And I know we talked about this during the initial onset of even COVID. Like, if there was a way, like you can go in and search US made, right? But there isn't like a tab where it's like, I only want, like where you can filter out, right? Like LinkedIn, you look up a company name and then click first for all those that you're first level associated with. If you could go into Amazon and search, you know, light holder, and then I'd like to search made in North America, you know, or made in the US, just from a support mechanism, it's not there to be able to do that. And I mean, I have my own personal reasons why I think that is, right? But if people started to pay more attention to that, right, where things are made, when, you know, when you buy something, it's the same thing of when I go online, right? Where am I looking? Where is this routing me to? How are networks built, right? Where's this network traffic going? If I'm doing crypto, where is this based at? Yeah, I looked it up. It's got a great website. Love the blinky lights, right? A buddy of mine works with them and he lives here in North America. It must be good, right?
And the fact that we're so well connected to people beyond the scopes we would have. These things can infiltrate faster, or it looks way more supported or supportable or legitimate than it ever did. You know, when we were all growing up in our towns and the people we interacted with were generally within our towns or the towns next to us. God, it feels like I'm in a shtetl in Lithuania in the 1800s, but that's how it was. We'd work, you know, you'd meet people in your town. And so these things, there was a little more closeness, a little more difficulty in it becoming legitimate. You didn't see that 100,000 people were already doing this same thing and therefore made it seem in the scale of your town way more legitimate than it might actually be. Right. And how does all this play into insurance? Or does it?
At the end of the day, insurance has existed for a very, very, very long time now. Everything you do in life, your car, right? In order to, if you haven't paid your car off 100% and you don't have insurance, right? Like your bank won't give you a loan unless that vehicle is insured. They're protecting their investment. Mm-hmm. Most companies today have some level of debt by the banks that they've taken money from in order to run or operate their business. They also want to have some level of insurance, right? That if something happens, that's not going to go down. So it's very much all tied together. I look at it as insurance not going down, but it's going to continue to go up. And you've said it before, Eric, water finds a way, right? So as you plug certain things, you know, you put your EDRs in, you've put certain controls in, you've been able to reduce your footprint, so your cost of insurance went down. But overall, the types of attacks are changing again, right? And the threat actors are finding new ways to cause new disruption. It's new ways. About how do we write policy,
right?
And the stronger the right policy, even if your insurance is still staying at this point, the more layers they put in there means the more controls or people you have to hire in order to manage your own security. So
let's take this a little differently and say, what happens, why would we, as the controls continue to get, as the restrictions continue to get greater, why would we consider outside insurance if in 95% of the or some larger and increasing percentage of the time, it isn't going to cover. Why would we take that on? And hence the rise of self-insurance, or the re-rise of self-insurance. And, oh, sorry, and along with the fact, the dirty little secret about cyber insurance, it's capped at an amount. You have a major event, you've capped, you got $5 million in insurance, that $5 million, and you have 1,000 customers, they're not each getting $5 million. That's not how this works. And so some of this stuff, I think, is based on some, you know, some they get false narratives, but also the scale. The fact that you are, like, in a car accident, you're generally not running over 100,000 people. So therefore, the $1 million cap in liability will probably cover all of the injuries of the people involved in the repair of the car, et cetera. But in an online case, in a software product, or in, you know, some kind of a cyber attack, would, I guess maybe this is more applicable to software products, because in a manufacturing line, you know, it's a much more direct item. But in the case of a software product, why would that $5 million isn't going to go anywhere near making the people who are affected whole?
Yeah. So where you're going with it, I agree the direction, right? Because I think a lot of times it should be looked at insurance. But almost it's cash flow, right? Money's going out the door. Should that cash flow go towards theoretical risk offset that may or may not pay out? Or is it better served to self-insure and actually put that into the security program?
But still having to put that up, when you self-insure, you still have to make it a set aside.
Sure, that is true.
So it's not as though it's liquid.
But I think in a lot of cases, number one, contractually, a lot of companies are now obligated to have an insurance policy, because we've now decided from a legal standpoint, well, that's, we want to cap our risk, so you have to have it. It's regardless of whether it's actually going to protect the company and keep them solvent if something actually happens. It has to be.
But not really capping our risk.
I think
we're capping our risk.
Sure. But I think a lot of times too, it's being considered as you have to have it to be in a defensible position.
Yeah.
It's looked at again.
I have to have homeowners in order to close a mortgage.
That's what it's being looked at.
But I don't have to have a good insurance. Whether it works or not,
it's irrelevant.
Yeah. I guess I see so many different paths here where the answer is, and some of this is going to be on the insurance market to keep their product palatable, keep it something I want to buy, rather than just say, screw you. We'll put some money aside. We'll put it off in a bank account and $5 million. And if something happens, you guys can all fight for it and have at it, because it'll have the same effect. And I think at some point, somebody's going to say, nope, we're not going to. We're not going to take on this insurance and pay it out and know that it's never going to pay out. Or maybe we'll take out a shitty insurance policy. Like, like the ones you see on late night TV during the movies. Yeah,
right.
Just enough to qualify.
Yeah. But that's kind of where you were going with your question. How did we get to talking about the complexity of the internet going there from insurance? And I think we would all agree that the complexity of the economic environment that we have today and the way everything is interconnected is exponentially more complex than we had in the not too distant past, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I feel oftentimes we still continue to try to use those levers in the past that we've used to apply to risk, and our thinking, I don't think, has evolved enough, and how we can start to curb some of the risks to actually materially matter to what we're facing on a day-to-day basis.
That's why when we were talking before, you kind of leaned in up on stage about insurance leading the way, is that insurance kind of is the forebearer leading the way, because companies are, to do business with certain companies, it's a requirement. And insurance is protecting themselves, not necessarily the people or the companies, meaning they understand that at this rate, if something happens, insurance companies do not lose money. And when they start to lose money, they change their plans so they don't lose money.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. They're not in the business of losing money.
So essentially insurance is making people become more secure, because if you want, I shouldn't say make them become more secure, is pushing them to do things in security more, and talk about security more, because in order to get their policy, right? I'm not saying they're doing the security things or putting the controls in. They looked at it and said, man, there's 10 more things we have to do in security. I am not going to name names, but I talked to someone that was like, hey, man, I got to talk to you. We need to do a pen test and we need to do some vulnerability scans. I was like, why? What's up? And he's like, we just got audited and we haven't done any for the last 2 years. I'm like, is this a requirement for your cyber insurance? He goes, I mean, we put it into our policy. It's a requirement from our auditors. And he's like, we just haven't been doing it. I was like, why is that? He goes, be honest, we just printed the policy off, took one from a standard New York firm and put it in. He's like, can we change it to say we don't want to do any of those? Would that make this easier? I'm like, no, you're absolutely required to do the one once a year and these two.
By who though? For your insurance. But by who?
Yeah, well, that's required. And I don't want to say by who, because then it will totally...
Well, no. But I'm saying by an insurance provider. No, your policy is what you do. If you can defend it and you have other mitigations, there is no law. There's no law in the that comes out of Washington, D.C. that says
everyone will have a pen test,
despite the desire of all the pen testing firms to have that law in place. And
no, this was required by their customer in order to be able to carry. Yeah, in order to be able to continue to do business, right? And he's like, can we just change it? I'm like, no, here's why. Because the vertical you're in, that customer requires this. That is the lowest minimum they have, right?
Mm-hmm.
I go, and it's not a suggested twice a year for this. It's a required twice a year vulnerability scan and one pen test. So well, anyhow,
you can also take the easier path, which is just cut them loose as a customer.
The insurance or the customers are going to push this further and further, right? Down the path of taking security more serious. Mm-hmm. But if it was government intervention, because at some point, and this has happened before in the past with insurance, that the insurance for the cost of this, et cetera, got so exceedingly high that then the government starts to ask why, right? And then they come in and start to really dig in. And although it takes way longer, that then they start to put some rules in place, right? I mean, there's a reason why NHTSA exists in automotive, right? Are you going to find something that exists for security? And does that mean that governments start to get involved more on the network traffic and everything else, similar to the shipping lanes of the free world?
Yeah. I mean, going back to the comment I made on that panel around insurance being I probably phrased it in the context of the right person to actually start to standardize that language. At the heart of that is a philosophical question. Is it better for the wrong person to push the objective we all know needs to happen, or for nobody to push it? And this is where I lean on, if they're willing to pick up the ball and they're willing to run with it for right now, fine.
Unless doing so pushes people in the opposite direction. Because I don't know about you, but we all have a friend. And if that friend were the one to tell you to do something, you would purposely go and do the opposite. The insurance provider needs to be the one that doesn't get seen as the bully, the bully, the instigator, the one who's just out for themselves, which I do fear they often right now are seen as. Back to the comment, they're not going to lose money. They're not going to lose money. They're going to make changes to make sure they don't lose money. So how do I know that this recommendation is really good for me? Again, not being, we're all very active practitioners, we can make this, but there are a lot of companies, especially now as smaller companies are playing in games where they're automatically and immediately expected to be this tall, to have all these controls. They don't have a mature security program. They have a technologist who see reading a list of things. How do they know which ones really help them? And that's back to just like compliance does not equal security. Complying with insurance does not equal security.
100%. Yeah. And I think all three of us agree on that. And just thinking about it, there is a fatal flaw in what insurance is looking for and present in just about every other framework that's out there. Nothing asks me about capacity. That's great. We implemented a ton of great technology. but nothing ever talks about, do you actually have the personnel you need to properly respond and manage that technology that's in place?
Mm-hmm. This is starting to come up in audits.
You don't even need people anymore. You have AI, Eric. It's AI.
And 5G.
And now, Brian, you've now just become that friend.
I have AI, Eric. I put the policy in AI.
You've become the friend now, Brian, that I immediately don't do the opposite. With that comment. And on that note, we're actually out of time. Guys, thank you so much for being here. Brian, Eric, as always, it's wonderful. And thanks to you, the listener. We really appreciate all that you do and all that you share and all that you bring back to us. And if you want to tell us more, if you want to bring back more to us, either ideas, thoughts, feedback, send us a message. securitydebate@distillingsecurity.com. That email address has changed. securitydebate@distillingsecurity.com. You can visit us on our website. All of our episodes are on the Distilling Security website. And there will be lots more things coming up there over the coming months. So bookmark it. You don't need to change any of your podcast feeds. Those will stay the same. The YouTube will stay the same. But just head over to distillingsecurity.com, sign up for the newsletter, and we'll send out information on upcoming events and other things as they happen. Thanks again, and we'll see you again on the next Great Security Debate.